Not the charts, babe.
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
The Jalagas issue of Discorder is here. Be sure to pick up a copy around town or check it out online at discorder.ca and catch features on Pat Locke, Dirty Spells, Horses Records, The Beelines, and so much more. Also be sure to peep the Discorder playlist, now available through SoundCloud. And a very special thank you to this issue's advertisers, Audiopile Records, CCEC Credit Union, Catalano Street Party, LiveVan.com, the Ponderosa Festival, the Queer Arts Festival, the Rickshaw Theater, Rifflandia, the Media Club, Vancouver Fetish Weekend, Vancouver Fringe Festival, Vancouver Queer Film Festival, the Victory Square Block Party, and Vinyl Records.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 18th of July, and I'm Sahar.
And I'm Marco. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5.05 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
Today's top stories and segments are our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science findings.
Also, we have a piece from the Northern News correspondent Morgan Yee, who spoke with Bev Clifton Percival about the recent eviction notice sent to corporations using Gitxsan land without consent and what implications this has for the communities within their territory.
Later in the program, we have two contributor segments from Chirag Mahajan, who went to interview instructors and kids at UBC's Gearing Up Science Summer Camp, and also an interview with Alison Bremner, whose work is on display at the Museum of Anthropology as part of the Claiming Space and Urban Aboriginal Youth Art Exhibition.
But first, some headlines for today. In local news, forest fires linger in the province's interior. A blaze at Smith's Creek has spread to threaten West Kelowna homes, with firefighting crews working today to stop the fire. No evacuation has been ordered so far, and hopefully the fire will not continue to spread. Thankfully, residents in the northeastern community of Hudson's Hope were allowed back to their homes yesterday when their evacuation order was lifted. The threatening fire is still burning nearby, but the risk has been mitigated by the recent wet, cool weather in the region.
In national news, the Duffy affair drags on as government prepares for October 2015 election. The RCMP has announced its decision to lay 31 criminal charges against Conservative Senator Mike Duffy, with the impending trial and testimony threatening the pre-election image of the government. Despite efforts to distance the Conservative Party from the scandal, evidence of Harper's former chief of staff writing a $90,000 check for Mr. Duffy may seriously hinder the party in the upcoming election. Of the 31 charges, Duffy faces 15 counts of fraud, 15 counts of breach of trust, and one count of accepting bribery for that same $90,000 check. Interestingly, the chief of staff who wrote the check has not been charged. The PEI senator will appear in Ottawa court on September 16th, but the trial could take until fall of 2015 to begin. The next fixed election is scheduled for October 2015, although Prime Minister Harper could call one earlier.
And in international news, Typhoon Ramisen continues in Southeast Asia. According to the Chinese government, the storm is headed towards southern China and has strengthened into a super typhoon. The storm, packing winds of up to 180 kilometers per hour, has already killed at least 54 people in the Philippines and is expected to make landfall in the provinces of Hainan and Guangdong sometime today.
Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 crashes in eastern Ukraine. According to U.S. officials, the flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur was shot down by a surface-to-air missile yesterday while flying over Ukrainian rebel-controlled territory. The crash killed 298 people on board, people without relation to the ongoing conflict, including Dutch, Australian, German, and Canadian citizens. Tensions between Russian and Ukrainian officials have only increased since the catastrophe, with both sides trading angry accusations of involvement. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said that it was, quote, not an incident, not a catastrophe, but a terrorist act, unquote, and his government laid the blame at Russian-backed insurgents' feet. Russian President Vladimir Putin said that responsibility for the disaster lay with the Ukrainian government, saying, quote, this tragedy would not have happened if there had been peace on the land, or in any case, if military operations in southeastern Ukraine has not been renewed. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak said no stone would be left unturned in the investigation of what happened to Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, adding that the plane did not transmit a distress call before crashing. Quote, if it transpires that the plane was indeed shot down, we insist that the perpetrators must swiftly be brought to justice, unquote. For this part, Canadian Prime Minister Harper issued his own strongly worded statement yesterday, saying, quote, while we do not yet know who is responsible for this attack, Canada continues to condemn Russia's military aggression and illegal occupation of Ukraine, which is at the root of the ongoing conflict in the region.
And in other international news, Israel has invaded Gaza. After 10 days of aerial and naval bombardment failed to stop persistent Palestinian rocket attacks, the Israeli government launched its ground invasion of the Gaza region yesterday. According to a statement from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office, the invasion's orders are to destroy tunnels that were allowing Palestinian militants to infiltrate Israel and carry out attacks. These tunnels have been recently been at the forefront of Hamas publicity campaigns, with one video showing footage of militants hauling rockets through one such tunnel, emerging at a launch buried in an orchard. An Israeli military spokesman said that Israel is not attempting to topple the dominant Hamas Islamist group, which would likely involve an attack on the densely populated Gaza city that has so far been avoided. Since the offensive began, one Israeli soldier and 23 Palestinians have been killed, according to the one Israeli and 228, adding to the one Israeli and 228 Palestinian deaths already reported by Gaza health officials during the bombardment. Of the Palestinian casualties, most have been identified as civilians. This is the region's most intense period of conflict in the past 2 years. At the end of 2008, Israel launched an invasion of Gaza during a three-week war that claimed 1,400 Palestinian lives and 13 Israeli lives. Most analysts say that the current conflict was largely triggered by the killing of three Israeli teenagers in the occupied West Bank last month and the death of a Palestinian youth in a suspected revenge murder. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius is on a mission to Egypt Jordan and Israel this week in an attempt to defuse the crisis. Fabius will be discussing the possibility of stationing a European peacekeeping mission on the Israeli-Gaza border, according to a diplomatic source.
Those are your local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
For a taste of the classics with a twist, join me, Marguerite, with Classical Chaos, Sunday mornings starting at 9, right here on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
In our weekly science and technology segment, we will be spotlighting research done in the field of science and technology by UBC researchers. In the first story, it's titled GPS and Cell Phones Monitor African Elephants in Real Time. UBC PhD student Jay Wells has built a sophisticated tracking system to monitor African elephants. It is intended to protect the elephants and understand their movement patterns. The tracking system allows real-time visualization of elephants' movements on Google Earth. Data is recorded by the collars on the elephants and then transmitted to the satellites, which reveal the movements in high-resolution pictures. But the data can also be transmitted to cell phones. This will provide security for the elephants from poachers and will also help injured elephants that need help in the wilderness. The PhD student, Jay Wells, is trying to integrate smartphone technology with the satellite technology to help endangered species by the elephant, or to help the endangered species like the elephants that are facing extinction. This is another way UBC is helping to make our world a better place. In another story, the BC Center for Excellence in HIV Research is helping doctors with early detection of signs of HIV. The program is a team effort with UBC, the Oregon Health and Science University, and Duke University of Medical Science. They analyzed data from 24,000 patients and found in 50 to 90% of these patients, doctors had difficulty distinguishing simple symptoms like fevers or swelling of joints or swelling of body parts from just ordinary illnesses. So the BC Now is, with this program, BC is instituting, it is becoming a leader in the diagnosis of HIV in North America. BC has introduced routine guidelines for HIV testing in BC. And with this effort, BC is now, the BC Center for Excellence in HIV Research is now Canada's largest and one of the international leaders in the world. UBC is only one of two Canadian universities recognized as a top 40 in the world each year, so UBC continues doing its good work. In another story, power drills by UBC researchers are helping doctors in Africa. When I think of this, I think, yuck, I would not want to be operated by a power drill. But in developing countries, they do not have the fund for expensive surgical tools. So engineers and engineering students from UBC are developing alternatives to expensive surgical tools for African nations. The problem is that the African nations cannot afford the expensive surgical tools. They don't have the doctors. So many people that need the surgery are not getting surgery. The power drills before have been difficult to sterilize, but the UBC students, and in particular, Michael Cancilla, a UBC grad who graduated in biomedical engineering with a master's degree, has developed a new waterproof cloth bag. It prevents anything from entering or exiting the drill, and the bag seals the body of the drill from any contaminants. This is done in partnership with Uganda Sustainable Trauma Orthopedic Program and UBC and the Mulago Hospital in Kampala. Twice a year, UBC surgeons visit the hospital and aid the doctors there and help with the surgeries. So that are three stories where UBC has been doing research for third world countries. In another story from NASA, the Rosetta spacecraft is approaching a twofold comet. As listeners may know, whoever listens to my weekly astronomy talk show, last week I talked about comets and asteroids. And there have been many missions to asteroids, but this is just the latest. The European Space Agency has sent its Rosetta spacecraft to photograph the comet, and it arrived there on July 14th, 2014. The spacecraft is now 7,500 miles from the comet, but it will zoom in and get closer. The comet's name, there's another comet that they're also going to study. It's called 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. And this is a new comet that is also providing surprises. It looks like a rubber duck, so its nucleus is an odd shape. These kind of spacecrafts will study the body and the head, will sample the dust from the comet, and will hopefully lead researchers into a better understanding of our solar system and our universe. In another story from the University of British Columbia, a new mobile app developed by University of British Columbia researchers in collaboration with the Child and Family Research Institute at BC Children's Hospital can measure respiratory rates in children roughly six times faster than the standard manual method. They can measure the data in 9.9 seconds as compared with 60 seconds using a stopwatch. Dr. Hung Gan is quoted as saying, "Mobile phones are changing how we administer healthcare, especially in rural settings. With this app," the doctor said, "we can give healthcare workers with fewer resources more faster and more accurate measurements." Researchers say this is a big step towards the better diagnosis of pneumonia and other illnesses. Pneumonia is the leading cause of death of children worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. With timely and accurate diagnoses, so says Dr. Hung Gan, children with pneumonia can be often saved with simple interventions such as antibiotics. This new device measures respiratory rate by tapping the touchscreen every time the child inhales. The app provides an animation of a breathing of the person breathing for a direct comparison with the standard breathing patterns. The next stage of this research is to further improve the diagnosis of pneumonia in low resource settings by combining this app with something called a phone oximeter. UBC researchers UBC researchers are now developing the phone oximeter to provide non-invasive measurements of blood oxygen levels using a light sensor and a mobile phone. In our last story, astronauts are testing housekeeping robots in space. Ball-sized, flea-flying, synchronized position satellites, which are called spheres, have been flying inside the space station since 2006. By connecting a smartphone to the sphere, it becomes a more intelligent, free-flying robot and with pictures and sensors to help conduct inspections and to collect data and make calculations. NASA is looking for the future where they can use this on the surface of Mars when and if man or humans colonize Mars. This is Marco. You have been listening to the latest science and technology news on CITR.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Center is happy to present its new collaboration with My Sister's Closet, a social enterprise of battered women support services. The SASC's Got Consent clothing items will be sold at My Sister's Closet, located at 1092 Seymour Street in Vancouver. The Got Consent initiative is a preventative campaign that creatively touches upon the necessity for consent to be present during all sexual encounters. The Got Consent branding is visible on a variety of clothing items, including t-shirts, underwear, and tank tops. It's also available at the SASC and the UBC Wellness Center in the sub, in addition to at My Sister's Closet. For more information on the Sexual Assault Support Center at UBC and the Got Consent campaign, go to ams.ubc.ca/SASC.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Hi guys, so I'm Christine and I will be giving you guys your weekend weather forecast. Right now, the conditions are partly cloudy. The temperature is 23.1 degrees Celsius with a humidity of 53%. Tonight, it will continue to be mainly cloudy with 40% chance of showers overnight with a low of 17. Tomorrow, we have conditions of mainly cloudy with 60% chance of showers, a high of 21, and a UV index of 6. For Saturday night, the conditions will be again mainly cloudy with 60% chance of showers before morning and a low of 14. Finally, for Sunday, there is a mix of sun and cloud with 60% chance of showers, a high of 22. And that is your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Weather Canada.
Correspondent Morgan Yee, who spoke with Beverly Clifton Percival, the negotiator for the Gitxsan Hereditary Chiefs in the Hazelton Upper Skeena region. Hazelton is a small community north and east of Prince Rupert, situated at the northernmost point of Highway 16. It is comprised of three small communities and seven native reserves spread out across a wide catchment area. The population is approximately 6,500 people. When the softwood lumber industry was booming, Hazelton was a thriving community. However, now Hazelton relies heavily on other natural resources to employ its residents, like fishing, hunting, and outdoor recreation. However, much of this activity is occurring on land which is under dispute or without Gitxsan consent. Similarly, gas exploration and other crown activity, such as sea and rail shipping, occurs throughout Gitxsan territory. The Gitxsan Nation sent out an eviction notice on July 10th, which called for all logging, mining, and sport fishing activity to cease by August 4th. This action comes shortly after the Supreme Court of Canada awarded Aboriginal title to the territory of the Chilcotin Nation. Morgan spoke with Bev about this action, how she believes the situation will be played out, and what needs to be done to reach an agreement.
Bev, welcome to News 101.
Thank you.
Can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you're doing in Hazelton?
My name is Gwans, Bev Clifton Percival, and I'm a negotiator for the Gitxsan Hereditary Chiefs.
And what's your role been within the Gitxsan Hereditary Chiefs?
My role is to negotiate a fair reconciliation agreement with Canada and British Columbia. We don't like the current BC treaty model, so we have been trying to propose alternatives. But the BC treaty model as it sits now is something that benefits British Columbia, so they really like that model. And Canada generally stands back. So we're still trying to achieve what we want is a legal agreement with the Crown about our conduct as we move forward and how our relationship progresses.
And for listeners who aren't aware of what's been going on up here in the last couple of weeks, can you give us a brief overview of what the Gitxsan Nation is asking of the federal and provincial government in terms of land use?
Well, what's been happening probably over the last couple of years, beginning in 2012, Canada and British Columbia in this treaty process model offered Gitxsan lands to the neighboring Indianak bands to the west of us. And this affects approximately 10 of our Huelp, which are our Gitxsan houses. So we're not happy with that offer. We have tried to make efforts to express our concerns to the provincial and federal government. And our ultimate goal is for a withdrawal of Gitxsan lands and an AIP for our neighbors. And so as a result of that, of course, BC right now has got LNG on their head, and that's their interest, and we see that. And so we did do a deadline back in April. We sent it out as of June 21st. If they hadn't withdrawn the lands, we would stop LNG talks. June 21st came and went. They hadn't withdrawn the lands. LNG talks are off the table. Having done that, the chiefs took next steps, and they decided that they would issue eviction notices to Sports Fishermen, CN Rail, and FlynnRail, used to be the Ministry of Forest. And we're asking that as of August 4th, people vacate Gitxsan territories.
And how would that be enforced if no agreement is made?
We're doing strategy over how we're going to handle next steps. Next steps, we're keeping all our options open. There are legal options. There are additional steps that can be taken with other Crown corporations or Crown entities. We're really trying to definitely get the Crown's attention. This week, for example, we did a half-page ad in the Vancouver Sun with the eviction notice. We've done a lot of media since we've done our press release last Thursday.
Now, has a lawsuit been filed yet?
It could be one of the options.
Okay.
And I think the other piece is that the Silcoteen decision came down, and the Silcoteen decision determines that you have to have consent before any activities happen on Aboriginal lands. Mm-hmm. The Silcoteen are where we were 10 years ago, so we feel that we are really on strong footing at this point to move forward if we choose to do legal options.
Was the Supreme Court ruling the big impact on the actions that have been taken now here?
What's interesting in reading the reasons for judgment is that they cite the Delgamuukw case of 1997. So by citing that, it just reaffirms that we're on the path that we're on, and that we're not going to deviate from that path. We are a matrilineal society, which means we go through our mothers. We have 33,000 square kilometers. We have a land tenure system. Our social structure is still active. And so every day we are living according to our own laws. And our goal is to achieve reconciliation with Canada and BC. And it's not a hard issue. They have to have the willingness and the political will to come forward.
Some people have expressed concerns about this ceasing of activity impacting Hazelton's tourism industry. Do you guys have any concerns about that?
No, because our fight's with the Crown, and what people have to do is put political pressure on the Crown to take action in a good way. And they haven't done so to date, and the only way the Crown usually takes action is through the courts, sadly, when a lot of this could be averted through discussion.
Do you feel that the actions that have been taken so far have been supported by the broader community up here?
I haven't heard otherwise. We've actually gotten some calls of support. I am going to be talking with the BC Wildlife Federation people this afternoon, so I think that we do have support, and we do have, like I say, it's not about having confrontation or conflict. Our fight is with the Crown, and so all the Crown has to do is set up a meeting, get to the table, and do some good faith negotiations and have honor.
Now, if the Crown is willing to come and have these discussions, would most of these activities be allowed to resume?
Ultimately, they have to withdraw that land, so we need a commitment on that, and we haven't gotten that commitment to date. We've had a lot of nice things said to us by the Crown, but that's simply not enough. We need to have our land. Our society as a nation depends on it, and it also puts at risk all the other house groups, that anything can happen to them if the Crown chooses to do it, and that's an infringement, and the law is telling them, the law is on our side, that they cannot do that anymore. They need consent.
And just going back briefly, when we're talking about the disputed land that was Gitxsan territory, how does that generally get resolved? Because I know there can be conflicting histories about who's actually held that land.
Well, for the Gitxsan, we did our first foray into court in 1987. And we have been in the courts on several occasions through the British Columbia Supreme Court of Appeal, Supreme Court of Canada, and we have never had any challenges to our boundaries. And that is the time to challenge if you are challenging our boundaries. And we did, before we went to court, we did have agreements with our neighbors in the traditional way that these were the boundaries that we'll set. Because according to our territorial affidavits, our boundaries are actually bigger than what they say. But we agreed with our neighbors in good faith that this would be how we do it. And that's the traditional way of doing it.
Looking at the CN Rail activity, because yes, that cuts right through, and it's sort of hard to change that. What would we be looking for in terms of their activity?
Well, they'd have to obtain consent before they're crossing gates and
lines. Okay, but it wouldn't be like rerouting or anything?
No, okay. It would be like negotiating out an agreement again with the proper title holders.
And is the Gitxsan Nation looking for any compensation in terms of these Crown activities?
Would that be part could of it? Be an option. I think we just have to get to a table and see what's what. And that's the best alternative, I think, in all of this, is that we go to a table. The Gitxsan have always been prepared to reconcile. It's the Crown that has lack of political will or mandate to do so because they've created such a narrow scope. And this Supreme Court decision also talks about things have to be looked at through the constitutional Section 35 lens. That's a very big opening for us. We are articulate. We know what we want. We've been very clear from the get-go in this treaty process and reconciliation what we want.
Is this at all leading up to something like what the Nisga have right now, where they have more control over their territory?
Well, we want the decision-making to extend to the 33,000 square kilometers, and not in the terms of a veto or anything negative. We're all here to stay. Let's find our way to work together and achieve that reconciliation in a legal agreement that binds both of us, or all three of us, actually, as tripartite.
Because it would be federal, provincial, and...
Yes. Because when you talk about the Constitution, that's Canada's responsibility. So British Columbia actually has to follow suit under the Constitution.
Okay.
And that's our goal, because we don't need to deal with just one or the other Crown.
Now, are we looking at just industry, or is that also affecting like other government-run agencies, like schools and stuff? Would that be impacted?
I think we have to get to the table and discuss that, and that we want to be a part of Canada and British Columbia. We're not looking to be separated, which is what the current model does. It separates people out. And that's kind of segregation. It doesn't lend itself to true reconciliation, which is that we're all here to stay and we need to survive together.
Has there been a lot of involvement with all the different bands throughout the Hazelton area?
The Gitxsan have always represented themselves as proper title holders, which means it is the hereditary system and not the Indian Act system.
Everyone's
involved.
Okay.
And everyone will have a say on anything that we do in terms of if we reach agreement on anything. Everyone will have their say in that, whether they accept it or reject it.
And how long are you expecting this negotiation process to go on for?
I hope not forever. It's been too long already. I mean, 20 years into this process, and it's got so many flaws. Why is Canada and British Columbia not fixing the process so that it's expedited, and not in a fast way, but in a way that's more meaningful for First Nations? I think that as leaders, we need to be positive. We need to provide hope to our people. We need to have a sustainable economy, and that's our goal here in the Hazelton. Since the downfall of the forestry industry, there's really been nothing. Now you have all this pipeline business and LNG. We have to consider that Mother Earth can only sustain so much. So whatever we do has to be done in a sustainable way and a long-term way, but also allows the land to rest and recreate itself for future generations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Morgan. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Join us on Chips and Dip every second Thursday afternoon, 1 to 2 p.m. with host Hannah Fazio for the freshest local indie pop tracks and upcoming shows at CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us today.
For our next segment on the show, we have an interview with Alison Bremner. Alison is a Tlingit artist from Yakutat, Alaska, currently residing in the Seattle area. She delves into her rich, complex culture through painting, jewelry, and regalia. Chirag Mahagan met with her to discuss her contribution to the exhibit.
My name is Allison Bremner. I'm a Tlingit artist from Yakutat, Alaska, which is the northernmost part of Southeast. I'm currently in Seattle, Washington, learning more about traditional art. I work with a variety of mediums. As a child of two cultures, native and non-native cultures, I'm interested in the positive outcomes of when cultures meet. So I try to use humor to depict the modern native today. That's the lens I find in which I tend to view the world. There's been a lot of despair in First Nations history, but there's also been a lot to celebrate. And I think stereotypes of First Nations people are this stoic, somber individual. And people, if you're not involved in the native community, you don't often get to see, you know, the sense of humor that, you know, maybe your aunties have, which is so, it's unique to First Nations culture, but humor is also shared by everybody. So I find that if I can tie humor into it, someone will grab onto the piece more than if it was just, you know, a straightforward design. The city to me represents a merging of cultures. Again, I'm currently in the city to pursue art. I'm learning from my mentor, David R. Boxley. He's Tsimshian. He's also from a rural community, but all of the jobs and all of the work is in the big areas, so that's why we're there. And I find that we tend to group together people from the rural areas, and because we have the shared perspective of sort of being outside of really the city life. Being in the city, I'm able to be around things when they happen, and I'm very interested in depicting the modern native, the person who has ties to tradition but functions in today's incredibly fast-paced society. So I get a first-hand experience of, you know, people and places that I might otherwise not. And I do find today's, you know, pop culture society very inspiring. The Claiming Space exhibition means a number of things. It's pretty wonderful that the museum is choosing to represent our culture as something living, as an institution that works so often with the history and the past of our cultures. It's fantastic that they're choosing to showcase the present and the future, and I hope that people will come away with knowing that our Aboriginal youth have these incredible thoughts and voices, and our culture is in really good hands. And it's been phenomenal to meet the other artists who I've admired for quite some time, specifically Kelly and Cody. And it's given us a context to meet, and I hope to know them for a very long time. And I'm very grateful to be able to represent the Tlingit Nation in such an incredible exhibit. With Kelly, I really enjoy her Male Gaze painting. That's one where I saw it online and immediately I wrote her an email without having met her before, saying, "This is fantastic, I can't wait to meet you." So the Male Gaze, I think because I can relate to it quite a bit. And with Cody's work, all of Cody's work is just phenomenal. And It's been wonderful to meet them both, and I think they're going to have really bright futures. So it's an honor. I hope that visitors will take away the sense of awareness that Aboriginal youth have, and regardless of how contemporary a work is, there's still that deep pride of the nation that they're from. So I hope people will recognize that Aboriginal art isn't always necessarily this, and, you know, put in a box, and, you know, with their preconceived notions of what Aboriginal art should be. And I hope that they'll open their minds to what it is and what it can be. And I hope the artists themselves take away a continued passion for the art, and I hope everyone is very proud of themselves, because they should be. It's a fantastic exhibition. So the piece I'd like to speak about is Live Long in Potlatch, which is the shirt that I am modeling today. It was chosen by MOA to be sold in the gift shop for a period of 1 year as the official t-shirt of the Claiming Space exhibition. And the shirt represents, it has a wonderful gift tag that you can read that will explain a lot, but it represents, to me, the positive merging of Native and non-Native cultures, and the incredibly connected world that we as people and as Aboriginal youth live in today. Every day, Aboriginal youth wake up, and especially urban Aboriginal youth wake up, and they're just slammed with media images. And so this is my humorous take on the individual who I mentioned earlier is tied to tradition, but functioning, if not thriving, in the modern world. Thank you very much to MOA and to the curators and to everyone involved. It's been a complete honor, and I'm very grateful.
The Claiming Space exhibit opened on June 1st, and will be open at the O'Brien Gallery at the Museum of Anthropology until January 4th next year. Up next on News 101, we have Chirag Mahajan's piece on UBC's Gearing Up Science Summer Camp.
Gearing Up is a science summer camp at UBC for children, both young and old, all the way from grade 1 through grade 12. Gearing Up is designed, organized, and operated by UBC students and the Faculty of Applied Science, and in its 19 years of running, it has reached over 80,000 children. The camp gives kids an opportunity to explore engineering, science, and technology through fun, hands-on experiments in a safe environment. The camp runs weekly from July 7th to August 28th. CITR Radio joined the instructors and some of the kids during their Friday pizza lunch break to chat about their experiences at camp so far. Here's what they had to say. What's your name, sir?
Matty.
And how old are you?
Six.
We're both six.
I'm six.
This is gonna be on the radio.
This is gonna be on the radio. Yeah. I'm gonna interview a bunch of your teachers and edit it together. So, and add some music.
Can we come in after every teacher talks?
Sure.
Yay.
All right, let's go talk to some of your teachers.
We actually go all the way from our six-year-olds, who you've met quite a few of them now, and those are our mini-minds. My name is Courtney, and I am an instructor for the Explorers A. Well, I'm actually in a dual degree program here at UBC, which is physics and education.
So my name is Wen Ling. I volunteer here at Gearing Up for 2 years in high school, and this year I'm returning as an instructor, so I am studying biomedical engineering here at UBC. I just finished my first year.
Hi, my name is Patrick. I'm an instructor here at Gearing Up. I teach the Imagineers, which is grades 4 to 5, and we try to promote science, technology, and engineering for kids.
Hi, my name is Tanjot Singh. I am one of two co-directors at Gearing Up. The classes are divided up by age group, so we have camps for kids that are in kindergarten all the way up to grade 12. So our littlest group, they are the mini minds, and they are kids that have just finished kindergarten and they're going into grade 1. We have explorers, who are grade 2 and 3, imagineers, who are 4 and 5, inventors are 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 are our innovators, and then new this year, we have our masterminds program for kids that are entering either grade 11 or 12 or their first year of university. lots of crazy things happen at camp.
We did lots of science.
Fun science. Making stuff.
Like flubber.
And today we got to make robots.
We got to make robots. Brush robots.
Really?
Brush bots.
Well, what we were doing this morning was really awesome because we were dyeing these bandanas.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of colors did you use?
Well, they were food dyes, and I did hot pink and red.
We are in our 19th year of running camps at UBC. I started about 19 years ago when someone in the faculty and a bunch of students got together and realized that this was a need in our community, and they banded together and started an organization that later became Gearing Up. I think what makes us so special is that we do have a lot of hands-on stuff. Although we do have some time at the beginning of most lessons that are instructional, that are kind of similar to what they're used to in school, because we're a camp, we want them to be busy all the time and to have hands-on activities. So I think that is something that makes us different. I think you really have to put yourself in their shoes. Like, if you can't teach it like a university lecture, you have to go in and think, if I was in grade two, what are my thought processes? One of the things that we did at Gearing Up is that we researched different age groups. We look at what are kids going through at different ages, and obviously we can't cover everything because each child is different, but we look at like different developmental things. Like, for example, mini minds, a lot of them have just finished kindergarten. It might not have been full day kindergarten, and they might not even know how to read. So things like that is something we have to consider when we're looking at the different age groups.
Could you describe the reactions the kids have when they first come into summer camp and when they leave?
So Monday mornings, everyone is still very shy. They are in their bubbles. So we try and play a lot of music. With the younger kids, the mini minds, when you play the Lego song, they're all like all together. They break out of their bubbles and they just start singing together. Friday, on Fridays, I feel like they're more themselves. You can start seeing their personalities come out, and they're just really excited about science and engineering.
I think there's like a mixture of wonder and curiosity. A lot of the things that we do are meant to be over the top and super exciting. So I think a lot of the kids are shocked that science can be so cool. So I think it's a lot of wonder.
What was your favorite part about the summer camp so far?
Well, my favorite part was probably making boats or launching a real rocket right over there on the field.
Well, I like the rocket launch too, and then mine only got like this high.
Aww. But mine went this high.
That's cool.
And mine went like higher than that.
I think my favorite experiment was today because we made robots.
Did the robots move?
Yeah, we had a computer program that we needed to use to set the robots to move.
Did the robots have arms and legs or wheels?
They had wheels, and there was instructions so that we could make sure we have all the right parts.
What was your favorite experiment in the last week?
It was like making potions.
Were they different colors?
Yeah, they were.
What was your favorite color of potion?
The purple one, and also the turquoise one.
I'm sure you didn't get to taste them, right?
Yeah, because the teacher said we're not allowed to eat science.
Talk a bit about the importance of the Girls Only Week.
Okay, so the Girls Only Week, as a part of trying to reach out to more girls in science and engineering, because girls are really underrepresented in this field, so this is the only week where we have girls only, and we try and get them more involved.
So girls only is very important because as a student, I see myself that a lot of the times there's not that many girls in the camps or also in classes. And it's kind of unfair that there's the stigma around it being engineering's a guy thing. And it's really good to get a nice balance going, get because a lot of girls are really smart, they're really interested in all the sciences. It's really good to have a safe environment for them to work in.
As a lot of people are aware, there is kind of a void in science, technology, engineering, and math careers and fields of women. There aren't a lot of women in these careers. So the Girls Only Week was initially started to engage girls from a very young age in thinking about STEM careers and just thinking about how, or just envisioning themselves actually living a life where they could be doing STEM all the time. So that's kind of where it came from.
When kids go home, what do you hope they take away as citizens of the world and as future scientists?
I hope that one thing that kids get from gearing up is not being afraid of science and not dreading their science classes. I hope that they take away from this experience that science can be fun and engineering is fun and so is math and technology, and that they can have careers in it and they can have fun with it.
I hope they'll just take an excitement for science and also a sense of wonder and just wanting to know how things work and why things work and to try and explore some more of the stuff that we've talked about at camp.
Great. Right. Thank you so much for talking to CITR.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chirag. That's our program for today, July 18th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Sahar.
And I'm Marco. Today's show was produced by Christine Kim. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
CITR's weekly astronomy talk show with your host, Marco.